Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Associate Professor Kylie O'Brien, PhD, is an academic educator and researcher who has been actively involved in Chinese medicine and integrative medicine for the last 18 years. And for the past 12 months, she has been one of the foremost educators on medicinal cannabis. She's an adjunct associate professor at Torrens University. Kylie, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast. How are you today?
Yeah, very well, thanks, Pete.
It's been a long time coming. We've been juggling this for so long, and I can't believe it's actually happening.
We have.
So let's get stuck into it, because this is I won't say it's a contentious topic, but I think there's a lot of misunderstanding where people don't actually understand what cannabis is in relation to marijuana and how it's used medically. So I'd love to be able to explore all of these, I guess, topics and themes. And how I like to do these podcasts, really, it's basically for me as a learning tool and also a sharing tool. But fundamentally, my daughters listen to these, and they're 12 and 13 at the moment. And also my mum, who's in her 70s, also listens to this. So I always ask my guests if they can basically simplify their material as if nobody has ever heard about this before. Okay, so.
Okay, fantastic. I'll do my best.
All right, let's start with the basics. So what is medical cannabis, and how does it differ from marijuana? If you can give us the two definitions, that would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, look, marijuana and cannabis are basically the same thing. It's just a different name. And in the US, they tend to use the word marijuana a bit more, I guess. Now, cannabis can be used medicinally, or can be used recreationally, and that's called adult use. Now, I guess a definition of medicinal cannabis is cannabis or cannabis products that are used specifically to treat illness, ideally prescribed by a qualified healthcare practitioner and individualised to the patient. And of course, cannabis has been medicinally used for thousands of years.
Thousands of years. So let me break away from that for a minute. So what is hemp?
Okay. So yeah, it's confusing, isn't it? But look, hemp and cannabis are both terms used to describe a plant from the genus Cannabis. Now, colloquially speaking, hemp is a term used to describe any cannabis plant that's cultivated for fibre and seed. So hemp is still the cannabis plant, but it's been cultivated or bred to have very low amounts of the potentially intoxicating constituent called THC, which I'll talk about later on, although it still may have high amounts of one of the other main cannabinoids as well. So in Europe, for example, the upper legal limit for cultivation of hemp for fibre and seed productions is 0.2% of THC on a dry basis. Now, hemp is used in the industry for oils derived from the seeds and its fibre. So oils from the seeds are used in human food, in the nutraceutical and cosmetics industries, and they're used for livestock feed, for example. But the fibre from the stalk and the leaves is used in the textile and paper and plastic and building and car industries. So something I found out recently when I was in a conference in Borneo, of all places, was that if you look under the bonnet of Mercedes-Benz, some of the parts are actually made from hemp. So hemp seed oil is the oil that you get from cold pressing the ripened fruit or seeds of the plant. Whereas, and hemp seed oil doesn't contain the cannabinoids, which we'll talk about in a moment. They're the main active constituents, apart from perhaps trace levels that might be present due to sort of inadequate cleaning of the seeds. And look, there's a lot of products on the market, Pete. There's oil, there's meal, there's flour, breads, protein powder made out of hemp seed oil. There's hemp honey, hemp pesto, hemp bars. There's combinations of hemp seed oil and curcumin. There's hemp seed oil with olive oil together. There's external skincare products and there's shampoos. So there's lots of different products that are made out of hemp seed oil. And it does have some amazing health benefits, I'd have to say. So it's rich in essential fatty acids. And it's got lots of protein, so almost as much protein as soybean. It's got lots of vitamins like vitamin E and C and thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, B6, A and D. Lots of minerals like phosphorus, potassium, sodium, magnesium and many more. But one of the interesting things is it's got this ideal ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. So in a typical Western diet, the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 is about 20 or 30 to 1. And this high ratio has been linked with a lot of chronic inflammatory conditions, including coronary heart disease and cancer and diabetes and arthritis and many other conditions. But in hemp seed, this ratio is between 2 to 1 and 3 to 1. So it's very similar to the Mediterranean Japanese diets, which have got low rates of heart disease.
Which is basically the same as the ratio as grass-fed meat as well, being basically 2 to 1 as
right.
well as wild
yeah.
seafood. So it makes a lot
yes.
of sense that it's in the good fat range.
It's an absolutely... That's right, it's got a great food, but it's also got these other components called lignanamides, which is a bit of a mouthful, but they show potential, when you look at the research, to reduce neurodegeneration, and some have even got some anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer properties. So there's some very interesting research. So it shows some promise, I guess, as what we call a functional food for prevention and treatment of a lot of different conditions, particularly those that are underpinned by inflammation, and that's a lot of our chronic diseases.
So... how long has this been used throughout history that we're aware of?
So cannabis has been probably, there's been evidence of human cultivation and use for probably, look, it depends on what source you read, but some sources said over 6,000 years. Another source that I read the other day said over 10,000 years. Now, in ancient India, more than 3,000 years ago, they used what they call bhang for anxiety. In eastern China, cannabis was discovered in 2,500-year-old tombs. And when we look at what was happening in the US in the 1860s, the colonists grew cannabis for hemp export to make rope and paper and fabric, and was also used as tinctures for migraine and pain and spasms. And there was even, I guess, some evidence perhaps that Queen Victoria might have used it also for period pain. So from 1850 to 1937 in the US, cannabis was used as a prime medicine for more than 100 different diseases in the US pharmacopoeia.
And then?
Well, then we had something called the Marijuana Tax Act passed in, I think, 1937 in the US. So basically... marijuana or cannabis was prohibited. So there's a lot of reasons why that might have happened. There's various sort of, I guess, theories. One of them was that there was, a fellow called Harry J. Anslinger, who was in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And once alcohol was allowed to be used again, he had a rather big staff. And what were they going to do? So they looked at marijuana, and also that Mexicans were coming into the US and they were smoking and bringing marijuana with them. So there's lots of sort of, I guess, reasons why they might have decided to prohibit it. But they've called it a Schedule I drug, which is a controlled substance. And that's a category reserved specifically for the most dangerous illicit drugs like heroin and LSD and ecstasy. So basically based on the 1970 Controlled Substance Act, drugs from this group have got a high potential for abuse and they've got no accepted medical use in the US. And that's really interesting given that you had so many medical conditions on the US pharmacopoeia. So there's a lot of politics behind why it was prohibited. There were other industries, I guess, that hemp would have been competing with, like the nylon industry as well. So I guess the upshot of it all has been that in the US, federally, it's a scheduled drug. But as I'll talk about later on, there's a number of states in the US in which the use of medical cannabis has become legalized.
So I want to get into the medical side of this because you've been campaigning and teaching people about medicinal cannabis for quite some time now. So let's dig in to understand how it is actually used.
Okay, so medicinally, predominantly it's the oils from the flowers that are produced in these gland-like structures called trichomes, which are rich on the flowers of the female plants and also some on the leaves. Now, if we look back in ancient Chinese medicine, and I'm trained in Chinese medicine, the seeds were actually also used in Chinese medicine in a well-known medicinal formula to treat constipation. It was a formula called Mazarinwan. And as I mentioned previously, hemp is used in industry, the oils from the seeds used in human food and the nutraceutical business as well. So there are different kinds of medicinal cannabis products. Now, there's the raw herb. So in countries like the US, the raw herb, the flowers, leaves can be smoked medicinally. And then there's proprietary forms of the actual medicinal cannabis products. So you can get botanicals, they're dense cannabis extracts, and you can get those in capsules or pills or sublingual, that means beneath the tongue, sprays, suppositories, patches to put on the skin, and topical ointments. Then you've got cannabis-based liquid extracts. So these are more drug-like, I guess, and they're on the market, like nabiximols, and they've got an equal ratio of THC and CBD, two of the most well-researched cannabinoids. And then you've got single-molecule drugs. So these are synthetic or semi-synthetic prescription drugs, like nabilone and dronabinol, and these are approved by the FDA in the States.
Okay, so how does all that work?
Okay, so when you understand the plant, there's actually more than 500 chemical constituents in the cannabis plant. Now, the main constituents is over 120 cannabinoids, and they have got many therapeutic actions. And we'll talk about two of the main ones in a second. Then you've got terpenes or terpenoids, and these have also got therapeutic actions, and they give the cannabis products their characteristic aroma. So limonene is one of the terpenes, and if you've got a lot of limonene in it, it smells lemon-like. Alpha-pinene, so you can smell that if you go for a walk in a pine forest. So these are in other plants as well, of course. If you've got a lot of alpha-pinene, it's going to smell like pine. And then, of course, you've got many other plant nutrients that are in the cannabis plant too. So two of the main cannabinoids, the best researched, are something called tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, and cannabidiol, CBD. But only THC has the intoxicating properties, and these are dose-related. And all the other phytocannabinoids really don't have this intoxicant activity. Now, something a lot of people don't know is that the plants themselves contain the acid forms of the cannabinoids, so THCA, A for acid, and CBDA. For acid. And neither of those are actually intoxicating. It's only when you heat the plant or it ages that the acid form of THC and CBD gets converted to the tetrahydrocannabinol or the CBD.
Well, what I'd like to do just quickly is, I guess people, when they think of marijuana or cannabis, they think about getting stoned or getting high, which is the active component, which is the THC, but it's not the THCA, which is the acid. So I just want to define, what does getting high actually mean for anybody that's never heard of the topic before? And if there's kids out there, like my mum who's never smoked before, what happens to the body and the brain?
Okay, so look, it can be, I guess, many different reactions in the body. But basically, it's a sense of euphoria that, people who use it on the adult, for the adult use or recreational market. They're looking for that euphoria, but it can have other sort of effects on the body as well, including giving you a dry mouth and things like that. But that's not how it's used, I guess, medicinally. So you're not trying to get a high when you're using it medicinally. You're actually trying to alleviate symptoms, such as pain, for example.
As we're seeing in the marketplace now, it's becoming more of a supplemental or a medicinal avenue for people that really want to heal their bodies and their minds,
That's right.
Without the effects of being stoned, for instance, from the THC.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right, yeah. And of course, it's very much dose-related as well. So to avoid that, you obviously need to control the dose of the THC because that's the component that can give you that intoxicant sort of effect. So that's why it should be prescribed by a qualified healthcare practitioner, you know, in its correct dose, individualised to the patient, of course.
And the THC component where you actually do get that euphoria or the high can be very beneficial for certain people as far as creativity goes, as far as pain goes, as far as understanding themselves more, because it can bring up things to work on from a psych level.
Yes, yeah, look, as I said, most of my sort of research has really been more on looking at its effect, you know, for example, on helping pain and many other conditions. We'll talk about that in a moment. But what I think is really important to understand is that these phytocannabinoids, we actually have our own endocannabinoid system. We make our own cannabinoids in our body, and a lot of people don't understand that.
Okay.
So us and animals, we both all have our own endocannabinoid system. So there's three kind of components to that. So we make our own. So endo just means within cannabinoids, and a couple of those are called anandamide and 2-AG because it's quite a long word and I don't want to have to try and say it, and there's some others. Then we've got receptors in our body, and then we've got the proteins involved in synthesizing and transporting and breaking or metabolizing those cannabinoids down. So if we looked in our bodies, we have receptors for these endocannabinoids in our brain, in our peripheral nervous system, in our organs. So we've got two main types of receptors. One's called CB1, and they're concentrated in particular in the central nervous system or the brain, and also some in the organs. And then we've got CB2 receptors, and these are highly concentrated in the cells of our immune system, but also some in our organs and our brains too. Now, the role of our own endocannabinoid system is basically homeostasis, maintenance of the status quo in our body. So it modulates our immune system, our metabolism or energy, our neural or nerve plasticity, inflammation and pain, our emotions, our cognitive function, our role in memory extinction or getting rid of bad memories. It's cell protective. It's nerve protective, and there's many, many other functions in our body. So I guess how do they work? It is complex. I won't go into it in too much detail, but basically you get nerve transmission from one nerve cell to another. These endocannabinoids, like anandamide, act to modulate our nervous system. So there's low levels produced in just regular daily life in homeostasis, but when they get stimulated, they get synthesized in larger quantities. So they might get activated, for example, in response to a painful stimulus or an infection or stress or inflammation or even exercise.
So this is happening to us without actually taking any in.
That's right. We make our own endocannabinoids in our own bodies.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was only discovered, you know, a few decades ago. So just to give you some examples, we've got these receptors in our body, CB1 and CB2 receptors, which help modulate the pain pathways and help provide a pain relief or analgesia. Our CB1 and CB2 receptors are involved in regulation of our emotions and our brain or cognitive functioning. We've got CB1 receptors, which regulate our appetite and our gastric motility. And we've got also the regulation, as I said, of the immune and inflammatory systems with CB2 receptors. So they believe that many illnesses and states in our body could be associated with deficiencies in or malfunctioning of our endocannabinoid system. So many conditions, for example, mood disorders, depression, anxiety, seizure disorders, fibromyalgia, migraine, multiple sclerosis, irritable bowel, there's many, many different conditions that they believe could be involved.
So we make our own cannabinoids in the body. Cannabinoids. Yep. I just want to pronounce it properly. <That's> it. So yep. How does then taking, I guess, an external amount of cannabis help us?
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, look, the actions of the phytoplant cannabinoids in cannabis are many. So CBD, for example, produces many effects through many what they call molecular pathways. So they've actually identified more than 65 molecular targets of CBD alone. Now, THC binds to the CB1 receptors in the brain in particular and within the body. CB2 doesn't have so much binding affinity for either CB1 or CB2 receptors, but it modulates several non-cannabinoid receptors and what they call ion channels. So it is quite complex, but I'll give you some of the ideas of the cannabinoid actions. For example, antioxidant, antispasmodic, analgesic, nerve protecting, antiemetic, which means anti-vomiting, antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, antipsychotic, antidepressant, anxiolytic, so reducing anxiety, anti-glaucoma, and many, many others. So that's just, a list of some of the actions of these cannabinoids on our bodies. And even if we looked at the other component, the terpenes, there's more than 200 of them in the plant. So if we just take alpha-pinene, for example, that has anti-inflammatory actions. It's a bronchodilator, so it opens up the bronchi in the lungs at low levels, and it helps aid memory. D-limonene is an anxiolytic, and it can also produce or cause apoptosis, which is programmed cell death in breast cancer cells. So that's some cell line research there.
Wow.
So there's many, many other actions of these terpenes, and that's why a lot of people believe that whole plant extracts of cannabis are better than trying to just isolate one of the active constituents and bottle that.
Mm.
Because you get what they call the entourage effect of the terpenes plus the other phytochemicals in the plant, which are very important.
Of course. So let's talk about the scientific evidence then, because that's what a lot of people need for them to, validate what's happening out there in the world.
Sure.
When it comes to anything. So let's talk about the science. You are, yep, a professor, associate professor, so
yes,
teach me.
Okay.
Please.
So, look, a lot of people sort of say, oh, look, there's not enough research. Well, actually, I don't agree with that. There is quite a lot of research already at the cell level, in animals, and increasingly in humans. So the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine put together a report in 2017 where they summarised what they call the gold standard of medical evidence, which is evidence from randomised controlled trials and systematic reviews. Now, a systematic review is just when you combine all the results of randomised controlled trials together to come up with, I guess, an answer to a simple question. Does cannabis work in reducing pain, for example? So they put together this rather nice big book, and they came up with the conclusion that there's substantial or conclusive evidence for cannabis or cannabinoids in reducing pain, chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, and spasticity associated with multiple sclerosis, and that there was a moderate level of evidence for sleep disorders associated with a number of different conditions. Based on their research, they felt that there was less evidence for a number of other conditions. Now, we've got to remember that these were systematic reviews and randomised controlled trials. And when you think about the fact that medicinal cannabis basically has been prohibited in the US and many other countries for decades, and it's only relatively recently that we've been able to get hold of it and actually study it in humans. But there's been a lot of research done in countries like Israel, for example, that are also relevant to us. So when you look at, I guess, surveys of use. In Washington State, they did a survey and they found that the most frequently reported conditions for cannabis use were for pain, 61% of respondents, anxiety, 58% of respondents, depression, 50% of respondents there. And on average, the respondents reported an 86% reduction in their symptoms.
Wow.
And almost 6% of them use cannabis as an alternative to pharmaceutical prescriptions.
That's huge.
So that's interesting. Mm. Now, if we look at cannabidiol, and I like looking at this particular phytocannabinoid because it's not associated with that euphoric effect that THC is.
So cannabidiol is got a CBD.
CBD, that's it, yeah. So research suggests its benefit in a number of different conditions, including epilepsy and Dravet syndrome, which is a quite severe form of epilepsy, insomnia, social anxiety disorder, pain, chronic and neuropathic pain, diabetes, cancer, inflammation, neurodegenerative diseases, and, as I said, anxiety and psychosis. That's just some of the research suggests that there might be a benefit there. So I'll perhaps give you a couple of examples. In Dravet syndrome, where they've got severe seizures, they did a randomised controlled trial in 120 children and young adults, and they found that there was a median decrease in the convulsive seizure frequency per month. The CBD group went down from 12.5 to 6.
Wow.
And the placebo group didn't change much. They went from 15 to 14.1. Mm. So, you know, quite a dramatic shift there. There was another survey of parents of 117 children with high refractory epilepsy, so that means it's not treated well with drugs, who gave them CBD. And the median time before they tried the CBD was around 5 years. So there was a median of 8 unsuccessful anti-seizure medications that they trialled out before they actually started the child on CBD. Now, when they interviewed and surveyed the parents, they found that 85% of the kids had a decrease in seizure frequency and 14% had complete seizure freedom. And the median duration of the treatment was about almost 7 months there. Well, they did find some side effects, but they weren't common, except for increased appetite in about 30% of the kids. And they also found a high percentage reported improved sleep in about 53% of them, improved alertness in about 71% of them, and better moods in about 63% of them. So they're kind of interesting studies.
So if you're a parent and you've got the child with epilepsy,
yeah,
then yes. These are the people that need this to be legal, I guess, in to help
yeah.
them.
And look, yes, yeah, you're right. But there's so many other conditions. There was a study in Parkinson's disease. It was what they call an open label study. So that they just had one treatment group. They were just looking at cannabis. And this was actually smoking cannabis. This, I think, was done in the US. Now, the effect of cannabis, they looked at that on the motor and non-motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So they just had a small number of people, 22 patients, and they looked at, they did the measurements at baseline and then 30 minutes after smoking cannabis. And they actually found significant improvement in the motor symptoms. So that's the tremor and the rigidity and what they call bradykinesia, which is slowness in movement that characterises Parkinson's. And they also got improved sleep and pain scores, and they didn't find any significant adverse effects. So that was just a short study to see before and after. There's also, I have an interest, I guess, in China's herbal medicine and its role in oncology or cancer. And looking at the literature on the potential uses of medicinal cannabis in cancer patients, there is evidence that at the cell level, at least, that cannabis can act on the various cancer pathways, and also that it can be useful for the associated signs and symptoms of cancer. So that could be cancer-related pain, chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, anxiety and depression that people often have, sleep disorders, that sort of thing. So the cannabinoids have been found, again, through cell and animal research, to act through different cellular mechanisms. So they can reduce inflammation, they can induce what they call programmed cell death or apoptosis. So in cancer, Our cells normally die. That's called programmed cell death or apoptosis. But in cancer, that gets interrupted and the cells don't die when they're supposed to. So the cannabinoids can help induce apoptosis. They can inhibit the invasion of the cancer cells. And it can also help target what they call angiogenesis and cell migration. So angiogenesis is the new blood vessel formation that feeds tumours. And cell migration occurs when you start to get metastases of cancer. And animal studies have also shown that it can help reduce the tumour growth in brain tumours like glioma, in breast cancer, in prostate cancer and colon cancer.
Say that again for me, because that's probably the most profound thing that you've said today. So
yeah, so in animal studies, they've found that some of the actions of the cannabinoids can reduce tumour growth. So in glioma, blastoma, in breast, in prostate and colon cancer.
That's not.
So remember, these are animal studies.
Yeah, but that's not to be taken lightly then.
No, I think it's tremendous promise here. And, I mean, some other research they've done is that cannabinoids can act as analgesics in neuropathic pain, and they can actually help potentiate the analgesic properties of morphine and perhaps help prevent drug tolerance as well.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Because that just went over my head.
Yeah, so basically morphine, when you use that to reduce pain, some of the research is suggesting that cannabinoids can help that, so increase that ability for morphine to work. So I guess, therefore, you may not need so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, but they've used it in a palliative care setting too, Pete, with a study in Israel that was done between 2015 and 17. So they had nearly 3,000 cancer patients were treated with medicinal cannabis, and the average age was around 60 years. And the main symptoms were sleep problems and pain and weakness and nausea and lack of appetite. So after 6 months of follow-up, almost 25% had died because these were late-stage cancer, and 18.8% had stopped treatment. But of the remaining, 60% responded. And they found, with the people who responded here, 95.9% reported improvement and only 3.7% sort of reported no change and 0.3% had a deterioration. So, in other words, there was a lot of people who reported an improvement in their symptoms.
Wow.
And they also found that there was decreased use of pain medication and reduced opioid use and relatively minor side effects as well. So that study to me brought home the usefulness of it in palliative care as well. But it's interesting about opioids. Evidence from the US suggests that legalization of medicinal cannabis is associated with reduced hospitalizations related to opioids. And of course, you're probably well aware, Pete, that there's an opioid crisis in the US as well as Australia.
Well, again, let's just break down what an opioid is for anybody that's never heard of the term, please.
Yeah, it's basically our opioid is a drug, and it's used for pain relief, for example. But it's been found to be fairly highly addictive.
So it's generally doctor-prescribed or pharmaceutical?
Yes, oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, yep. But it's been associated with a lot of side effects and indeed deaths.
So talk me through somebody that, who is somebody that would be recommended to go on to an opioid as such?
Well, I guess mostly for pain, that sort of thing.
And from your understanding, you just said that it's a huge issue over in America, or is it here in Australia as well?
Well, it's actually both, yeah. So, you know, because of the side effects and because of the deaths from it as well.
Okay,
so, you know, you often see that it'll be what they call an opioid crisis. So they'll say, for example, the National Drug Institute of Drug Abuse says that every day more than 115 people in the US die after overdosing on opioids. That's something that I guess is a quote from the NIH in the States. So
people are prescribed opioids from their doctor, or is it like a GP or is it a psychiatrist? Who prescribes opioids, and do the people taking them, what do they think it's going to do for them?
Well, I guess they're in it to try and get some pain relief, that sort of thing. But
so physical pain.
Yes. So I guess there's a high percentage, I guess, of people who may misuse them, for example, as well. So that's why they're calling it a crisis, I suppose.
So the opioids are legal as long as they're prescribed by a doctor.
Prescribed.
But at the same time in Australia, that's we have cannabis, which is illegal mainly and is not being prescribed at the moment.
Well, it's actually not illegal, and I'll actually talk about that in a moment.
All right.
But I just wanted to finish off talking about the opioids thing because they did a study in 2017 in the US, and it examined the associations between state medical marijuana policies and hospitalizations related to marijuana and opioid pain relievers. And they found that medical marijuana legalization was associated with a 23% and a 13% reductions in hospitalizations related to opioid dependence or abuse and opioid pain reliever overdose, respectively. So the researcher concluded here that medical marijuana policies were significantly associated with reduced opioid pain reliever-related hospitalizations, but had no associations with marijuana-related hospitalizations. So I think that was an interesting study because, of course, it's showing that when you legalize it in the States, it's actually not going to put more people in hospital. In fact, it's actually helping reduce the problems associated with opioids.
So
it's interesting research there.
So let's talk about the safety of cannabis.
Yeah. Well, interesting. A World Health Organization report was published on CBD last year, 2017, and it said that CBD is generally well tolerated with a good safety profile, and to date there's no evidence of recreational use of CBD or any public health-related problems associated with the use of pure CBD. And they also said in humans, CBD exhibits no effects indicative of any abuse or dependence potential. June 2018, the World Health Organization's Expert Committee on Drug Dependence recommended that preparations considered to be pure CBD should not be placed under international drug control, as the substance was not found to have psychoactive properties and presents no potential for abuse or dependence. The THC, the other main cannabinoid that's studied, as I said previously, it can induce euphoria and laughter, increased appetite, dry mouth, occasional dizziness, and enhanced visual, olfactory, and auditory perceptions. So I think, Pete, this was what you were kind of alluding to before.
Music does sound a lot better.
I'll take your word for it.
And you can definitely get into the zone watching a visual movie or something like that, for sure.
I'll take your word for it. Anyway, in some cases, there can be more serious side effects like nausea and vomiting, but apparently these effects are mostly subject to tolerance with repeated exposure. There can be subtle cognitive deficits, so impaired attention and short-term memory, and in higher doses, in some cases, some people could experience anxiety and panic and confusion and disorientation, and even some transient psychosis-like phenomena, like grandiose delusions, that sort of thing, which tend to be modest in magnitude, reversible, and essentially caused by smoking cannabis. So we've got to remember a lot of these side effects are more related to smoking of cannabis, and when you're smoking in for the recreational sort of use of it, if you like, you're getting large amounts of THC, that psychoactive or intoxicant component. Now, when they looked at toxicity, this World Health Organization report basically said a lethal dose in a 70-kilogram human was approximately 4 gram, and that dose could not realistically be achieved in a human following oral consumption or smoking or vaporizing it, as THC has a large margin of safety. And they also said that the absence of deaths due with THC probably reflects the low density of these CB1 receptors in the brainstem regions that control our vital heart and breathing functions. So there haven't been any deaths due to cannabis. Now they actually did a systematic review of the safety of medical cannabis. So they looked at the adverse effects of medicinal cannabis. They included 23 randomized controlled trials and 8 other studies, observational studies of cannabinoids and cannabis extracts for various medical conditions. And they found that 96% of the adverse events reported in these randomized controlled trials were not serious. Dizziness was the most common one. And that the rates of non-serious adverse events was a bit higher, or was higher than those taking the medicinal cannabis compared to controls. But there was no difference between groups in the rates of serious adverse events. So the findings support conclusions of the Institute of Medicine that short-term use of cannabinoids for medical use has an acceptable safety profile.
Gotcha. So we've talked about some of the scientific research, and I guess it's interesting. Over the years, I've been talking about the benefit that choosing your food wisely can have on overall health. And it's interesting because people come back and say, where's your randomized controlled trial that eating meat and vegetables or seafood and vegetables is beneficial?
Yep.
And even though there's anecdotal evidence, like I've probably shared, wow, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of stories from all over the world, from all different walks of life and different ages. I mean, for me, what I like to see is those real stories of people reclaiming their health. So for you to champion this and campaign for this in Australia, you must have seen some amazing results firsthand.
Yeah, well, I guess I've had the pleasure of meeting a couple of remarkable young men, one of which has a brain tumour, and epilepsy. Now, he'd be late teens now, I guess, this fellow. And his mum had to take him offshore to get medicinal cannabis, but they found that this has kept his epilepsy in check. He's now able to lead relatively normal life for a 19-year-old young man, and the brain tumour has not grown in size at all. So that was one remarkable young fellow that I met early this year when we ran a public event at the Malvern Town Hall. I met another young fellow again around the age of 19 when I ran the doctor course in Sydney in September. And this fellow has stiff person syndrome, and it's associated with a hideously high number of seizures, and they are very, very painful. And his father showed us a video of his son with the seizures, and honestly, I was in tears at the end of it. I couldn't speak. And I thought, well, this is why all these doctors are here in the room. This is why I'm interested in educating these doctors, is to help young people like this. Now, again, this fellow has been helped remarkably. It's remarkably reduced these seizures, and he's living a relatively, normal life as much as you can. He occasionally has to use a wheelchair to get around or walking sticks, but he is living a much better life now that he's on medicinal cannabis. And again, he was another one that had to go offshore to get it at some point as well.
So when you say offshore,
now, I don't know whether you
mean overseas.
The US, yep. So out of Australia, yep.
And the US seems to have some of the strongest drug laws on the planet. But it seems that they're being more lenient and opening up the doors to medicinal cannabis, aren't they?
Yes, that's right. So look, there's in the US, there's either 31 or 32 states now allow legal access to medicinal cannabis. Interestingly enough, Canada has recently passed laws allowing adult use. So that went through in October this year. In Germany, you can buy medicinal cannabis through pharmacies, but you can actually buy the raw herb as well as the bottled forms, the proprietary forms of medicinal cannabis. So, you're able to get a decent range there. Thailand and Malaysia are currently considering decriminalising it. So there's a lot of change around the world right now.
Where are we with Australia?
Well, we know that it is available legally, and it has been for a couple of years. So there's probably almost, I guess, 1,800 people who've accessed it through what they call the Special Access B scheme. But we also know that there's about 100,000 Australians using medicinal cannabis on the black market. So I guess access to medicinal cannabis in Australia is still a bit difficult. And there's a few reasons for that, Pete, and I guess perhaps I'll walk you through some of it. There is, I guess, a lack of doctor knowledge about medicinal cannabis. We've got driving laws that make it an offence to have any amount of THC in the body. So even if you were prescribed medicinal cannabis and it's got THC in it, if you took it and you're pulled over for a drug driving test, you'd be gone. It's fairly costly in Australia, and it's only available to be prescribed by doctors at this point because CBD is Schedule 4 of what we call the SUSMP, which is basically our poisons code, and THC is Schedule 8, which means it's the controlled substance. So Schedule 4 is a prescription only, Schedule 8 is a controlled substance, and that means that, as I said, only doctors can prescribe it. And doctors have to go through one of two main access pathways. So a doctor, a GP or specialist has to go through a particular pathway, which adds paperwork and time to their day. And as I said, a lot of doctors don't understand cannabis, so they're not trained in it, and therefore they're probably reticent to prescribe it. So those two pathways are called the Special Access Scheme. Basically, the doctor applies for a specific patient to treat them with a particular cannabis product. Or the authorised prescriber scheme is the other pathway. So basically, a doctor applies to be approved by the TGA, Therapeutic Goods Administration, to treat particular conditions using specific nominated products. But they've got to apply through a human research ethics committee or a specialist college first and get approved there, and then to the TGA for the final approval.
So it's a, now, to make it's things a pain. More,
basically. And then the approval, you've also got to get approval from the state and territory health departments if you're going to use THC medicines, the Schedule 8 medicines. Now, that has been, you know, adding to the burden, if you like, on top of doctors. But the TGA have recently made changes, so the application has been streamlined with one online form, which now goes to the TGA and the State Health Department at the same time. But the peculiar thing about Australia is that there's a kind of a lack of harmonisation across our states and territories. So some states require a specialist to prescribe it or support its use. For example, Tasmania allows prescriber access to specialists but not GPs, whereas in Victoria, GPs are allowed to prescribe it. So there's this lack of harmonisation kind of across the board in Australia at the moment. So just to give you some idea of who's prescribing, as of December this year, there are 52 doctors who were authorised prescribers for specific medical conditions under the TGA's authorised prescriber scheme. And there were just under 1,780 patients who were prescribed medicinal cannabis through the Special Access Scheme. So you can see how the numbers are, they're there, but they're not huge, are they?
No, especially when you can go down to the bottle shop, anybody over the age of 18, and grab your medicinal drink for the night without a doctor's prescription,
yeah,
which could cause more harm than good.
Yes, well, I probably have to agree with that. So I guess, look, from my perspective, and I'm not speaking with my hat on as a fellow of the National Institute of Complementary Medicine here, I'm speaking as an individual, I do believe that access is a human rights issue, and I think there's an impact on the public who are unnecessarily suffering. So if we looked at just chronic pain alone, we know that 1 in 5 Australians live with chronic pain, and then 1 in 3 over 65 years have got chronic pain. And that's a total cost to our community of about $34 billion. So when we've got difficulties with access, that impacts adversely on Victorian and Australian medicinal cannabis industry as well. So we've got, I guess, a drive within industry here to be leaders within the medicinal cannabis space, but it's going to be difficult, I think, if access is difficult.
So how do we get this changed, if it is possible, or is it just a matter of time?
Look, I do think personally, it's my opinion, that I think Australia will eventually follow suit and legalise the adult use of cannabis as Canada has recently done. I think that's only a matter of time, but that's only my personal view here. And I guess it is my opinion, and it is shared by some of my colleagues, that in the meantime we need to make some more changes to our regulatory system that appropriately reflect the risk and at the same time open up access to medicinal cannabis products. So for a start, I think there's an argument to remove CBD from Schedule 4 of the SUSMP, the Standard for the Uniform Scheduling of Medicines and Poisons, and to regulate proprietary forms of CBD as complementary medicines. We've already got a very good, very high quality system for regulating complementary medicines in Australia. So in my opinion, removing CBD from the Schedule 4 would certainly improve things. It would still regulate the quality of it, but would certainly open up access. I do also think there's an argument to down schedule THC containing products which have got lower amounts of THC into a lower schedule on this poisons list as well. And I think there could be a system for licensing of healthcare practitioners who are appropriately trained and certified in the safe prescribing of medicinal cannabis, so that there isn't this need to go through this complex process to be able to prescribe it. I think what we do need to do fairly quickly is decriminalise the presence of THC in the body whilst driving by patients who hold a prescription for medicinal cannabis products containing THC, provided the individual is not impaired. Mm-hmm. So for patients with medicinal cannabis prescriptions, for example, we could apply the standard impairment tests during roadside drug driving testing. And this is what Canada does too, by the way. So they're just some of the way forward.
So if people want to help, I guess, speed up this process and make it happen, what's your advice?
Look, again, personally, I would encourage people to talk to the local MPs and ask them what their stance is on medicinal cannabis, and to write to their local MPs and demand that the issue of access to medicinal cannabis is looked at. And when it comes to voting, I'd encourage people to vote for politicians, if you feel strongly about this, who are willing to stand up and fight to effect changes that will allow greater access to medicinal cannabis in Australia. As I said, these are my personal views on it.
Thank you for sharing. It's interesting because I had a fellow called Sean Dollinger on the podcast a few months ago, and he's the CEO of a company called Namaste Technologies over in Canada. So we've been having a dialogue over the last 6 months now, and we're actually looking at working together on some products for the Canadian market in relation to food. Mm. So we've created this friendship, and it's been really fascinating watching what's happening in Canada, because obviously I believe they are the front runners here for the rest of the world in as far as decriminalisation and access to marijuana and cannabis, I should say, for their country. And what's your perception or opinion on what is happening over there?
The Canadians aren't fools either, and they will have looked at this very, very carefully. And as I said, I think that they've probably done what we might eventually do here, is to look at it and with, you know, as I said, a sensible eye on the risks as well as the potential, I guess, benefits, and looking at it also as a human rights issue. They will have probably looked at it in relation to other things like alcohol, as you mentioned before, as well. So personally, I think that we've got a lot to learn from Canada, and I think that we should be looking at what other countries are doing. And we don't necessarily have to copy them, but we could take parts of it and adapt it to our Australian sort of situation.
You've been in this industry, as in the health industry, for so long.
Mm.
And I guess I'd just like to understand, or to wrap up this podcast, is why are you so passionate about this happening in Australia, and at this particular time you're campaigning and you're teaching and you're pushing for this?
Again, I've trained in Chinese medicine. I've been working in that since 2000. Before that I was an optometrist, quite a different profession. And when I've looked into the literature about medicinal cannabis, and I've got a background in clinical research as well, this plant is one of the most therapeutically diverse plants I've ever come across. It absolutely fascinates me. And I think sort of understanding that we've got our own endocannabinoid system and how it potentially works within our bodies, to me, is fascinating. Now, I've obviously seen patients in the clinic because I practice as well, and some of them are taking medicinal cannabis and finding great benefit. So when I've met people who've been denied it and have got great benefit, like, as I said, those two young men I met recently, and I've met other people. I've met a lovely woman who has Parkinson's disease and takes that, and it's quite remarkably changed her life. For me to deny people this form of medicine is wrong. And I guess, you know, for me, it's about human rights as much as anything, Pete. And as I said, I am a herbalist, and I think that this plant has got huge potential for many, many different conditions. And yes, we do need some more research in many different conditions. We need our government to support and help fund that research as well. So for me, it has become a bit of a passion, and this herb, as I said, has grabbed my attention like no other herb ever has.
Thank you for sharing. And I'd love to finish off the podcast to, I guess, delve into a little bit of what Kylie would like to share with our listeners as one of your favourite, I guess, ingredients for your recipe for life. And it doesn't have to be food-related, but what brings a smile to your face?
Look, I think one of the best recipes for life is to have wonderful relationships with your families and friends. You know, for me, that's the best form of medicine. It's actually love.
So well said, so short, so sweet, so true. Kylie, thank you so much for your time today and for you campaigning this and championing it for Australia. And I just want to applaud you for your tenacity and your determination and your passion. And I just want to say that we love you and I love you. And thank you so much for today.
My absolute pleasure, Pete. It's been great talking with you.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.